The No Film School podcast was brought to you by Blackmagic, creating revolutionary solutions for film, post-production, and television. And by Rode Microphones, your partner in podcasting. Hey everyone, this is George Edelman, editor-in-chief at No Film School. And today on the podcast, we have a very special interview we did with Dan Mirvish, who is one of the co-founders of Slamdance. If you're not familiar with Slamdance, you definitely should be. It's one of the great film festivals for up-and-coming filmmakers. They really prioritize people starting out, working with less, and creating a community, especially at the festival itself, which is in Park City at the same time as Sundance every year. So I had a chance to sit down with Dan and talk to him about how Slamdance started, why it started, the history of it, how they've interacted with Sundance over the years, and what their goals are going forward. But Dan is also a prolific independent filmmaker in his own right. He's been at it the indie way, I should add, for decades, continuing to create and release indie features really on his terms, going through it, the DIY to some extent route. But it's also important to note that Slamdance has had many, many great talents come through. Christopher Nolan, the Russo brothers, and many more. Not to mention that even though Steven Soderbergh is a huge Sundance figure, obviously, he's had plenty of stuff come through Slamdance as well. And I think he would probably say it's a little closer to his spirit in certain ways. So we're excited about Slamdance 2020, just as much as we are about Sundance 2020. It's a great place for filmmakers, Slamdance that is, to interact and come together with one another, because the vibe of it, networking-wise, is a little less industry-focused and a little more craft-focused. So if you're looking for collaborators, or if you're looking to meet people who are sort of starting out and finding unique and new ways of doing things, Slamdance is a great place for that. And it all happens at this one hotel at the top of the hill at Park City, while Sundance is also happening. So anyway, hope you enjoy my conversation with Dan. He's great. We've had many of his posts on No Film School that he's authored about his work and about Slamdance, and we'll have them again this year. So enjoy, and please check back for all of our Sundance and Slamdance coverage coming up in 2020. We'll have plenty of interviews, podcasts, coverage of films, and conversations about what's going on. I want to talk about a lot of things, but mostly about how Slamdance started and Slamdance's mission statement and what's happening with Slamdance this year, 25th anniversary.
Okay.
So I know you've told this story a lot.
No, that's all.
I've read it a few times, and I know you have the book, but I really want to sort of recap for some of our listeners who are unfamiliar with it, how Slamdance, because so a lot of people I meet know that Slamdance exists. It's one of the big festivals on everyone's list to submit to. They know it happens. They know it's somehow around Sundance, but I don't think people recognize one of the funniest things about Slamdance that I've learned is that it's literally right, like you say, a snowball's throw away from everything that's happening with Sundance. It's right there at the same time.
Yeah, yeah. And that was really the point, because we had, we started in January 95, so this is our 25th year, or our 25th festival that we've been doing it. And you know, back in 95, you know, it was kind of a different environment in the indie film world. It was kind of a real interesting transition phase between, you know, sort of the Sundance had kind of got on the map in 1989 with Sex, Lies, and Videotape, Steven Soderbergh's film. And then in the early 90s, there were, you know, all these great filmmakers coming out of it, like Tarantino and Robert Rodriguez and Richard Linklater. But by 95, Sundance was so kind of preeminent that that if you got into Sundance, you know, you could, you know, win the lottery, essentially. You could get a distribution deal, get an agent, get your next deal made, find romance, all these things, to say it politely. But there were a lot fewer festivals at the time. So if you didn't, and by the way, not every, filmmaker at Sundance, would that happen right. to you. But if you didn't go to Sundance, that definitely would not happen. It was before
the internet.
It was before the internet. It was before people could find out about indie films. It was before, thousands more festivals came up. It was even before Toronto was as big of a deal as it was. It was before South by Southwest was showing films. We hadn't started yet. So, I at one point had I had done a film called Omaha the Movie, which it was a first feature that was counted as a thesis film at USC where I was a grad student. But it was a full-on indie feature. And my producing partner was Dana Altman, who happened to be Robert Altman's grandson. So that was cool. So Robert Altman was kind of our mentor on the film. But we shot it all like with no-name people in Nebraska on film because that was the only way to do it. We shot
35?
On 35 mil and using Panavision cameras, and we actually edited it on the Paramount lot. They gave us a free edit suite at Paramount with like all the upright moviolas from 1935 we could use,
That's just amazing.
But it was great because we were on the Paramount lot, which was pretty awesome. But anyway, so we'd finished this film, and then at the time, kind of the paradigm was that you would go to what was then called the Independent Feature Film Market, the IFFM, which is now called IFP Week, in New York around September, beginning of September, end of August or something. And all the indie filmmakers would bring their films there, bring their prints, and show the film mainly to festival programmers and distributors. And the main festival programmers you wanted to see it there were the Sundance programmers.
Right.
So the year before, for example, Kevin Smith had taken Clerks there. Sundance programmers had seen it. They invited him, and he became the next Kevin Smith.
The rest is history.
Clerks took off, and that was great, which was fantastic for Kevin. So by 94, September of 94, we went there with our film, Omaha the Movie. There were 94 other completed features there, plus they showed works in progress. And, at our screening, which was a packed screening, Robert Altman came, which was great. We had a distributor, like a good solid indie distributor from the time, Samuel Goldwyn Company or one of those.
Yeah.
And say, we love the film, we want to distribute it. I was like, oh my God, that's fantastic. Yes. She said, but if it gets into Sundance. I was like, wait, what? She's like, oh yeah, if it doesn't get into Sundance, we don't want it. I was like, oh, well, are you going to help us get into Sundance? No, we're not going to do that. And this was actually someone who was the acquisitions person there who had previously been a programmer at Sundance. So she knew the ins and outs of the scene back then. So, well, we had heard of a couple individual filmmakers the year before. So in January 94, who had shown up at in Park City, didn't get their films into Sundance, and did their own little renegade screenings. So there were a couple people that had done this. So Trey Parker and Matt Stone, later
Heard
to be
them.
Known as the South Park guys. Well, their thesis film out of the University of Colorado was a great film called Cannibal the Musical. It's an amazing film. And for whatever reason, Sundance didn't take it in 94. So they rented
think of a few reasons.
Yeah, I know, yeah. And they rented their own screening room just in a hotel. And this is way before South Park. Nobody knew who these guys were. And, they got a little bit of attention. A couple of people showed up, and talked about them. There was another guy named James Marandino showed his first film. Later he would do SLC Punk and a bunch of other films. Yeah. But his first film was called The Upstairs Neighbor. He did the same thing. He showed up in a hotel room. And then there was this group of guys led by Matthew Harrison in New York who had this little collective called Film Crash. And for like two or three times in the early 90s, they would show up in Park City and do little short compilations of these, underground New York East Village, films. And so we had heard about all these guys kind of individually, and this was kind of in the back of our mind. That was kind of our plan B, like, okay, we think we're going to get into Sundance, but all you other filmmakers, good luck. You might want to think about this kind of plan B, just showing up anyway. Because we owed it to our investors, we owed it to our actors, we owed it to ourselves that, if we didn't show up at Sundance, what was the point? Because you know, because what the scene was like then was that, you know, other regional festivals in the U.S., and there were still some, and international festivals, if they wanted to show a group of American independent films, features, they would just take the Sundance program guide. Again, this is before the internet. And then just contact those filmmakers. So this, it was great for Sundance filmmakers because they would just travel the circuit as a group pretty much. So,
and premiere status wasn't important to those other festivals.
Exactly. Yeah. But meanwhile, the other sort of big trends that were going on at the time was that, you know, around that time of 1995, that was Miramax had just sold to Disney. Fine Line had just become part of Warner Brothers. Fox was about to launch Fox Searchlight. So it was kind of the Hollywoodization of independent film. Mm-hmm. That was the high point of it. You know, these indie films were winning Oscars and stuff. So all of a sudden, there was this, you know, much greater pressure, I think, on Sundance to show films by second-time directors with bigger budgets, bigger stars, and bigger potential for distribution, or films that already had distribution going into the festival. And so because of that, they wound up picking literally zero films out of the IFFM that year, or zero of the 95 completed feature films, not a single one got into Sundance. There was one work in progress called Brothers McMullen that got in.
I've heard of it.
Yeah. but it largely got in because Fox Searchlight was about to launch with that film.
Right.
And so they sort of helped usher it in. So we were all stunned. And there had been a group of us indie filmmakers from around the country that had met at the IFFM. And my producing partner, Dana Altman, who lives in Omaha, still lives in Omaha, you know, he was really isolated from the rest of the indie filmmaking community at the time. And so we decided to have this meeting, this grassroots meeting of indie filmmakers at the Angelica in the lobby. And a lot of people still remember this meeting, you know, just to kind of figure out, like, what kind of grassroots thing can we do to communicate with each other and stay in touch and support one another. And we never really came up with an answer. You know, we were just like, we got to do something. And this is before IndieWire, this is before email really had taken off. So, but that kind of planted the seed. So one of the other filmmakers that was there, Shane Coon, who had directed the film, a film called Redneck that Matty LaBatique was a DP on, okay. Oscar nominee Matty LaBatique. It was his AFI thesis film, basically, who had also shot in Nebraska and also was editing in L.A. But anyway, so when Sundance didn't announce their decisions and none of our films got in, Shane had the idea to kind of combine this Plan B idea of showing individually in Park City with kind of Dana's collectivist idea of helping each other, and said, hey, why don't we get like a dozen feature filmmakers and combine our resources, you know, because some people have press connections, some people know how to project, you know, are projectionists, and you know, different things like that, and do something in Park City. Come to Park City, do our own festival. And then Shane's partner, Brandon Kells, came up with the name for Slam Dance, which was great. You know, we're like, that's gonna look awesome on a T-shirt in 25 years. You know, and it still does.
It does.
And then shortly thereafter, you know, we sort of announced it. It was in Variety. Of course, we didn't have a website or a phone number or anything. So Variety did mention that I was working selling VCRs at the Good Guys Electronics Store in Westwood. So people started to show up there and just bring me tapes.
That's one of the best parts.
Yeah,
of the story.
Which is just kind of bizarre. Their submissions
were VHS tapes. They handed off to you at a Good Guys
selling TVs. Where I was selling TVs, and then I would put them on the big screen TVs, and like me and the other guys, the other salesmen would watch them, and then
that was programming.
Yeah, it was very strange. And there was one time in particular where I was selling a 7-inch black and white kitchen television to Kevin Pollak, who was about to go to Sundance with The Usual Suspects, and like people kept coming in and like dropping off tapes. He's like, "What kind of operation is this, man?" And I was just trying to upsell him on the 5-year extended warranty because that's where the commissions were, right? And God bless Kevin, he paid for the 5-year warranty. I hope his TV's still okay. But anyway.
But he was like, why is this guy getting anonymous VHS tapes handed off?
Yeah. I sold a VCR or something to Sam Rubin, who was like the entertainment reporter at KTLA. And so then he started writing, you know, saying stuff about Slam Dance. You know, that was how he did it. But AOL was just starting, and they had picked up the Variety article. So like Eugene Martin is a Philadelphia filmmaker. Like he had AOL. He was, you know, so he's like, so we started getting like submissions from New York and Philadelphia. And then Paul Rackman heard about us. He had a short film called Drive Baby Drive. So he approached us. He was in LA at the time. He said, oh, you know, you guys should really show short films. We're like, why should we show short films? We have enough trouble with like a dozen features. He's like, well, my producing partner's a projectionist. We're like, I guess we're showing short films. so that kind of launched, you know, then we had a dozen short films, which is great because, you know, the more the merrier, and people did bring different, you know,
and shorts have since have really become a way that filmmakers cut their teeth, learn what they're doing right and wrong, develop their concepts for features. It's like a great training ground.
And especially for Slam Dance and Park City in general, so many of our most successful alumni are you know, became successful because of the shorts. You know, Napoleon Dynamite started as a Slam Dance short, you know, things like that. So
there's almost like there's too many to mention.
Right? Yeah.
Really it's are. Like, as you could go on with so many people, nobody realizes that they started at Slam Dance because they started with really like kind of experimental or like their learning process films at Slam Dance. And Slam Dance creates a culture and an opportunity for filmmakers to do just that. It doesn't, like, you don't have to already be making your way in the industry like you do at Sundance. And what's amazing about the story is that that was true about Sundance as long ago as 1996.
Yeah.
Because a lot of people today will talk about Sundance, you know, it doesn't feel like it really makes room for the true independent who's just starting out. And people feel that today, but that's been true for nearly 30
It's been true
years.
For a long time. I mean, if anything, it's more true now in the sense that now Sundance has all these great labs that they do, which are great. But because of that, then they're sort of, you know, inherently obligated to show so many films that have gone through their own labs. Again, which is great in and of itself and perfectly good films, but it's left out, you know, it's left fewer and fewer slots for, you know, so this random filmmaker from Oklahoma City, you know.
Right.
Those filmmakers feel much more at home submitting to and being a part of Slam Dance because our submission process, we don't have any labs, we don't track filmmakers, we're like, you know, we don't pay attention to any of that stuff.
Well, in a way, the festival is the lab.
Yeah.
You know, in a way, the festival is the place where the learning and the connections happen. And I, you know, the culture, the vibe, if you will, in the Treasure Mountain Inn versus the vibe on Main Street is very different. It's people who are filmmakers exchanging business cards and meeting and like, oh yeah, I liked your film, I liked you this. And they're kind of like networking in a very, it's just a different kind of networking. I don't know how else to describe it than is happening elsewhere at like the, you know, Chase Sapphire Lounge. It's just a very, very different vibe. And I think that that's kind of like, it's closer to something like a lab where filmmakers are learning about each other and about what they're doing.
Well, and they're finding future collaborators. I mean, this is Slam Dance is where Christopher Nolan met Wally Pfister, who, you know, wound up DPing his next 10 films, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, this is where this is where Steven Soderbergh met the Russo brothers. This is, you know, this is where I mean, I've found my last two cinematographers and my last two producers and some of my actors you know, for my last two films here at Slam Dance. So it's an ongoing community of filmmakers.
You know, for you, one of the co-founders, still making features and still meeting the people you're working with at Slam Dance, it's like a renewing source of inspiration and talent.
Yeah, no, I think I met my lead actress for my next film here. She doesn't know it yet, but I mean, that's exactly, you know, I mean, already this morning got a contact from a casting director who did one of the competition films here because I really liked her casting work and I need a casting director for the next film. So, yeah, it's already started to happen. You know,
for a lot of our audience, people who are looking for ways to get connected to other filmmakers, reasons to go, say, to Park City, to spend the money to be there, to see stuff, to meet people, one of the reasons is that at a place like Slam Dance, there's a greater opportunity to find the other people you might work with. You may not have it, you have to be at a slightly different place in the industry to be doing that with some of these Sundance events.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the thing too that I recommend to, you know, no film school viewers and listeners and readers is, you know, because I hear this from a lot of filmmakers, like, oh, I'm not going to go to Sundance, you know, in Park City until my film is in. And no, film festivals, you should go before you make your films, you know, or
you're echoing a sentiment I held in my heart for years. This is my first time up here.
Oh, okay.
And all my life I always thought, I'm not going to that place until I have a movie there.
Yeah, yeah.
And I realized almost as soon as I got here how foolish that is. Because if you go and you see stuff, not just meeting people, you're seeing what's there.
Yeah, and getting inspired.
Why are they programming these things? Yeah. What's the kind of thing they're looking for? What's the kind of thing? What's the vibe at Slam Dance? What are the features like? What are the artists like?
Right.
You know. And if you don't know that, then you're working in a vacuum and you lack the inspiration and connection.
Yeah, because if you know, if you're just relying on Netflix, you're never going to see 90% of the Slam Dance or Sundance films. You know, so yeah, exactly. And there's so many like great panel discussions at both Sundance and Slam Dance, and you know, and you know, parties and hot tub summits and things like that. You know, and South by Southwest is a similar vibe. Like you can learn a lot just by going to these events.
Yeah, places, I mean, I think that, you know, since things have opened up in the festival world dramatically, you know, and Slam Dance, it's sort of like one of the energy. So when I was in undergrad in, you know, early aughts, I guess they call it, I had a film professor who was talking about, she was a documentarian, and she was saying like, try to get something into Slam Dance. Go to Slam Dance.
Oh, really?
And it's like, I remember hearing about it
who
time.
Was that?
I forgot her name.
Oh.
She was a guest instructor who came down.
Oh, okay.
Down
all right.
Like,
well, cool.
But she wasn't a, she was just doing a documentary seminar.
Yeah.
Semester with us.
Right. Okay.
And I remember that's where I heard about Slam Dance because I was like,
neat.
What is Slam Dance?
Yeah.
And it was like, then, you know, within the next 5 years or so, like more and more of my awareness of festivals were blowing up, and then Without a Box app, like all these things happened in that decade, I feel like that made festivals all over the place more accessible to everyone.
Right.
The internet, basically.
Yeah, and you know, and I think one of the things we're most proud of at Slam Dance is that, you know, when we launched in '95, we started to break that Sundance hegemony, certainly as far as helping filmmakers get into other festivals. You know, because now regional and international festivals were like, there's more than just Sundance out there for American independent films? Oh, that's crazy, you know?
Yeah.
And they started to take our films and put them into their festivals. But also, the year we within that kind of year that we started was also the year that South By started films, the New York Underground Film Festival launched, the Chicago Underground Festival
Your first year was South By's first year?
Pretty much. They started in February or March of 94, and we were January 95. So, and then, in fact, you know, I took my film, Omaha the Movie, to South By, you know, played South By in their second year. You know.
Okay.
So, yeah, South By had been a music festival for a decade or something. So it was already on the map there. But as far as launching the film side, that was pretty new.
Yeah.
But also the Hamptons Festival launched, the LA Film Festival launched. So there was kind of like this blossoming, like we weren't the only ones who realized, hey, wait a minute, Sundance has a stranglehold, you know.
But you were the ones who were here and then got to be called a parasite.
Yes. Robert Redford famously called us parasites. But, and he's right, we are. I mean, but I look at it like we're like the, you know, the beautiful green moss stuck to the giant oak tree, you know, it just makes the whole forest look nicer, you know.
Yes,
so
that's a good metaphor.
Yeah, and I think, you know,
it's really part of the bigger picture of what's happening here. It enriches, like you're saying, it enriches the culture of what's happening in Park City these couple weeks, and it expands the offering. So, like, people should be aware if you come up to see stuff at Sundance, you have an opportunity to see stuff also at Slam Dance, and then that's going to open you up to different kinds of content, too.
Yeah, and honestly, I mean, we didn't invent the wheel either. I mean, in 1969 or 68, a group of French directors didn't get into Cannes, and they started Directors Fortnight. Well, 50 years later, that is still a separately organized event that happens in Cannes. And then Critics Week is started by a bunch of disgruntled critics, you know, in 62. And that's still going on. So, you know, we have a ways to go before we, you know, make it to 50 years. But it's, you know, that was a great precedent. And internationally, a lot of filmmakers are like, oh, Slam Dance is like the Director's Fortnight of Sundance. Like, and if anything, that made Sundance look more like Cannes, you know. And that helped put Park City on the map in a way.
Yeah. I think an interesting person to look at career-wise in terms of Sundance and Slam Dance, we were talking about this back at our apartment the other night, is Steven Soderbergh, because he really made the movie that built Sundance.
Yes,
like the movie that sort of turned it industry.
Yep, exactly.
And then he came here.
Yeah.
And then he became intertwined with the identity of this event.
Yeah.
And I think that's fascinating.
It is.
Just in terms of how it, just in terms of what happened to, if you want to push the envelope, if you want to push the medium, it was like, well, you can't really do it. He did it there to such an extent that then it became cemented, sort of.
Mm-hmm.
And then it was like, well, I'll go over here now, because this is where you can, and now, and that's renewable.
Yeah.
It's a renewable source of pushing the envelope.
Yeah.
No, as we saw with the movie he screened. But it's like he has a movie he produced. I think it's just such a funny juxtaposition. There's a movie he produced down there, down the street.
Oh, but really? Okay.
I don't, if, the report, I think he's like a producer on it. But he's up here with
Slam Dance.
A movie at Slam Dance that's pushing us in a new place. He's shot on an iPhone. You know?
Exactly. And he's, you know, I mean, I met him at South by a month after we started Slam Dance, and I thought he was Mr. Sundance, that he was going to hate us. And then I met him, and he was like, oh, man, I love you guys. I love what you're all about. And I want to bring Greg Mottola's film Day Trippers, because he had just produced that. And I want to bring this crazy whack film Schizopolis that he was doing here. And then he brought that in 97. So, yes. And then, you know, we were in the back of the screening room, you know, projecting Day Trippers together. And I, you know, and we had to fix the projectors together. Like, Steven was on the floor like, Mervish, screwdriver, screwdriver, you know, pliers, you know, hatchet, you know, and like, bzz, you know, we'd electrocute ourselves. And then he got up at the end of the screening, and he, on the back of a chair, like, stood up and said, I vow that next year I'm going to help Slam Dance get real projectors. And we were like, yay, you know, and he did. He hooked us up with this company, Boston Light and Sound, that got us real projectors for the next 10 years. It was the same company that supplied projectors to Sundance. So, so that, you know, I mean, his help has been very tangible in a very direct way.
But I think there's also like a give and take, because it created a space that he could go and make the kinds of movies and find the kinds of talent, which he did.
Yeah.
Slam Dance helps him by bringing in filmmakers that he identifies their talent, and then he brings them to us, like Christopher Nolan, like the Russo brothers.
Exactly.
Like,
yeah.
So it's like a very like fertile farm system.
It really has been
for Hollywood, or for just filmmaking in general.
Well, and for Sundance, I mean, a lot of our filmmakers have, you know, I mean, by definition, Slam Dance has been very strict, at least in our competition sections. They have to be first-time directors with low budgets and with no distribution in place. So by definition, most of them can't show their second films here. I mean, we have a few slots for out of competition films that, you know, that we do show, but for the most part, their second films, if they, you know, a lot of them get into Sundance. And you know, I mean, that happened with Nolan, that happened with Ryan Johnson, with the I don't know about the Russos, but with a lot of filmmakers, and Lynn Shelton, Ben Zeitlin, you know,
right.
A lot of people.
I think one of
Drake Doremus.
Jeremy Saunier.
Zeitlin did 3 short films at Slam Dance, including one that we produced with him. Like, he did kind of for Slam Dance.
Okay.
So he was very much part of it. And I talked to Ben specifically about, you know, the fact that because he was at Slam Dance for a year or two first, he was able to hit the ground running when he got to Sundance. He literally knew, like, okay, I got to wear what boots to bring, you know, what condo to stay at, what publicist to hire, when to get my flu shot. You know, so he was, and I've seen this happen with a lot of Slam Dance filmmakers. Not only do their subsequent films go to Sundance, but when they do go to Sundance, they do very well there. Like, they're the hot films. They're the ones that are winning prizes, getting distribution, you know, getting the buzz, because they're not spending 3 days just, you know, being sick in their condo. You know, they're
figuring out how to get from the Eccles to the Park
Library. Exactly.
Because I'll be honest with you,
it's not
tough to figure out.
It is tough to
days.
Figure out. You know, I've been here 25 years. I still don't know how to buy a ticket to a Sundance film. It is so Byzantine, and they make it so hard.
It's
for
very
people.
Strange. There's like 100 lines there, different kinds of passes, different kinds of tickets.
Yeah.
And every time I walk in, I'm like, I know I have passes, but I don't know where.
I know.
I mean, you want me to be here, but I don't know where to be.
Yeah, I mean, as opposed to Slam Dance, where it's like, just show up and buy a ticket and stand in line. Like, it's not that complicated.
It's funny about that, because I think that when I walked into Slam Dance and I said, I want to go see such and such, and they said, well, yeah, it's a box office.
Yeah.
It's really, it doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
It's like, here's a box office, here's the theater, here's the line.
And it's all in the same building.
Right.
Like, I mean, Sundance is, you know, so spread out. Like, I literally have no idea how to buy a ticket, where to go to see a movie. And I mean, you know, it's not like they're listening to me for advice, but I mean, they used to be much more crowded throughout their 10 days. Now they're very crowded in that opening weekend, and then it just drops off.
I've noticed. Yeah.
And I think, you know, they've priced themselves out of, you know, young people coming to the festival. You know, they can't afford it, so they're going to go to South By, you know.
It's hard to get up here and be here.
And be here. It's expensive.
I think the second week, I would encourage people.
Yeah.
To try to come here after the first week, even though that's supposed to be fun, it's kind of madness.
It's crazy.
And yeah. I would try to come here after all that's died down and see as much as you can.
Yeah.
Because even though you may not get to, you'll get an opportunity to see the movies that are playing here and get a sense of what they are, which I think is invaluable. And if you do, like you said, like learning about how it all works here and like getting an opportunity to get the lay of the land, it's great. But to me, the thing about people learning how to get their, a lot of the movies that the established filmmakers who've gone through Sundance and gone on, who started in Slam Dance, their first movies at Slam Dance were opportunities for them to grow and learn. And I think that's an extremely unique opportunity. And if you, as you continue to have the mandate of first time features that don't have distributions, for anyone out there trying to make a first time feature, that's, you know, that's the place you want to get it, because then you're going to get to see what worked and what didn't. It's a it's a place for you to learn. Mm-hmm. As much and grow mm-hmm. as much as it is for you to be seen.
Yeah, I mean, that's what Slam Dance is all about. And so because of that, I mean, we have some great films this year at Slam Dance, you know, that you're going to hear from these filmmakers real soon. You know, they are, we can already tell, like, which yeah. ones are going to make their mark.
I think that's also cool because you get to see it before, you really do get to see the thing happening before it happens.
Yeah.
It's a unique opportunity at Slam Dance.
Yeah.
If someone's at Sundance, it's kind of already happening.
Right, yeah. I mean, people that were at the screening, for example, of our competition film, The Vast of Night, last night, are like, oh my God, this is the screening that people at Sundance wish they could say they were at.
Yeah.
You know, when it happened, because right. this guy, he's already shot his next film, you know.
Oh, yeah?
He's already been hanging out with, you know, people up here.
but see, that's
I shouldn't say anymore.
So that's the exciting thing, though.
It is exciting.
Because, like, we in our, you know, we're press, and so we cover a lot of Sundance. And back in our apartment, we all of us, what have you seen? And someone mentions a title. It's like nobody yeah. else even knows, because there's so many things at Sundance
right.
and they're all over the place. And it's like, was it good? It was okay.
Yeah.
it's, no, like, I mean, it's like nobody's having that the magic of discovery, which I think Steven Soderbergh mentioned, even he as a fan, it's we all kind of connect to that. I just saw something really cool. I want to yeah. know more about the yeah. person who made that
yeah,
thing.
Exactly. Yeah, and yeah, I mean, there's just so many films here because, again, we actively help these filmmakers get into other festivals, you know, because we don't just sort of let it happen by chance.
Yeah.
You know, just last night we had like a 4-hour mixer of other festival programmers meeting Slam Dance filmmakers, you know,
oh,
like
cool.
literally putting them in a room like a speed dating thing, you know, because we want them to go on
right.
and travel the world with their films and, you know, because that's how they're going
to
have fun.
That to me sounded like, I think when you told me about that, one of the coolest opportunities up here, it has nothing to do with seeing a movie, but just an opportunity to learn about what people are programming.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's invaluable if you're thinking about making a short or a feature, to find out where it might play, because every festival has different things they're looking for.
Yeah. I mean, just last night, like the two people that represent the Barbados Film Festival just flew into town yesterday, and I was like, okay, you guys got to come to this. Meet the Slam Dance filmmakers, and they had a great time, because
yeah.
who wouldn't want to go to the Barbados Film Festival?
Which was the film festival you were just at?
Barbados Film
yeah,
Festival.
Okay. so, yeah, so that must have been nice, right?
It's very nice, and a lot warmer than Park City. But
Do you travel to festivals all year long? Or you just
yeah, as much as my family lets me, and sometimes I take them with, and then they're happy with that, too. So with my last film, Bernard and Huey, which played at 30 festivals on 5 continents, and not the normal 5 either. I really traveled around the world with that, which was amazing. But then I also get invited to be on juries at festivals sort of in the off years when I'm not making films, you know, or do workshops or, you know, things like that. And that's always fun too.
Blackmagic Pocket Cinema Camera 6K has the professional features needed for feature film, television programming, and documentaries. However, now these same features can be used to revolutionize other types of work, such as blog videos, YouTube content, and more.
The combination of 13 stops of dynamic range, incredible low-light performance with dual-native ISO up to 25,600 for HDR images, and Blackmagic RAW provides feature film images with precise skin tones and beautiful organic colors. Featuring a larger 6144x3456 Super 35 sensor and EF lens mount, the Blackmagic Pocket Cinema Camera 6K lets you use larger EF photographic lenses to create cinematic images with shallower depth of field, allowing creative, defocused backgrounds and gorgeous bokeh effects. External controls give quick access to essential functions, while the large 5-inch touchscreen makes it easy to frame shots, focus accurately, and change camera settings. Visit www.blackmagicdesign.com to learn more. This podcast is brought to you by the Rodecaster Pro Podcast Production Studio, the revolutionary all-in-one podcasting solution from Rode Microphones. With four Class A microphone inputs, eight sound pads to trigger music and effects, the ability to stream phone calls seamlessly, Bluetooth and USB connectivity, multi-track recording, and so much more, it truly is professional podcasting made easy. Plug in your mics, turn up your faders, and hit record. Check it out alongside Rode's other podcasting innovations at rode.com/podcasting. One of the guest posts you did for us on Bernard and Huey was particularly about shooting a period piece scene in a garage in Culver City on 16mm.
Yes.
Which is like all kinds of production nightmare. And the thing that I loved about it when I read it was that it felt like it connected me to the roots of the things I was trying to do years ago, and the ingenuity or the desire to say, I think I can find a way to make this work.
Yeah.
You know, like exactly. I think it's actually not that hard. If I know the shots I really need,
yeah,
I think I can pull this off. And you guys did.
Yeah,
but like shooting on film, like it's funny because I didn't know when I read that you'd started at USC making a 35mm view. So for you, it was like, oh yeah, I'm back on film.
Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, exactly. And but I hadn't, you know, it had been close to 25 years since I'd shot on film before, you know. And it's funny, you know, people just think, oh, it's just the medium is different, but no, the whole rhythm of the set is very different. You know, like when do you put the slate in, and where does the boom go? You know, you have to rehearse that ahead of time when you're shooting on film. You can't just say, oh, boom up. And like, no, you're spinning money through that camera.
You have to say, check the gate at the end.
Check the gate. Yeah. And the actors are like, they can hear that money spinning through the camera. You know, people forget that a film camera is not silent. There is this constant whirring.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't get picked up exactly by the mic, or you hope it doesn't.
Yeah.
But the actors can hear it. The crew can hear it. So so there's all these weird little things that that there's a certain energy that you get. And hopefully it's the energy you want. You know, it's different from shooting digital. But yeah, and that I had forgotten about.
And in a garage. That's the other cool thing.
Yeah, in a garage. And by the way, I don't even know if I mentioned this in that piece, but our garage is a block and a half south of the Sony Studios, you know, which used to be MGM. So
right.
We're a block and a half south of where
Wizard of Oz
was shot.
Gone with the Wind.
And, you know, but technically, since we're south of them, they're in my shadow. So I always wake up in the morning, I go, yeah, the studio's in my shadow. You know, I don't know that they ever noticed that, but whatever, you know. But that's, you know, and that's kind of what Slamdance is like. You know, Slamdance is at the top of the hill.
That's
in
right.
Park City. We're not at the bottom of the hill. So, you know,
what you make runs down the hill and feeds the irrigates.
Yes.
That's the metaphor we're looking for.
Or the snowball, we run it down the hill and it turns into an avalanche by the time it gets to Sundance.
And then eventually all the way down to LA.
Yeah.
It's funny, whenever we drive by Culver City, because my son, who's 4, watched Wizard of Oz. And
oh,
I
great.
Say, like, you know, that's where they made Wizard of Oz. Because I think to him, that the idea of that is so bizarre. Like that behind that wall. That's
yeah,
where it was.
No, it really is. And when you and my kids have grown up there, and they, you know, they're just inundated with Wizard of Oz imagery and stories, and
yeah.
You know, the Culver Hotel
yes.
is where the Munchkins live.
Yes.
That's the Munchkin Hotel, and there's crazy stories of Munchkin orgies that you try not to tell the 4-year-olds.
But you know. Eventually they'll Google it.
But they know. And Veterans Park there, the playground is literally modeled, has a yellow brick road built into it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, so there's all these kind of weird things.
Yeah.
And stories. That's what's great about living in LA. And I think people don't understand it. I mean, we've got a guy on our block who was a prop master for 50 years on like 10 best picture winners, you know.
Oh, really? So he was in the worked at the
studio.
Yeah.
Yeah. In the studio system. And, you know, and people are just around and will tell you stories. You know,
yeah.
you don't have to go to film school to learn great, you know, great filmmaking stories.
No.
Just show up in LA and it's knock true. On doors.
You so, know? Yeah, I mean, I didn't go to graduate school, but a good friend of mine went to SC graduate school.
Yeah.
And we were very fortunate. People were still giving out film to students and shooting film.
Yep.
So we got to shoot a short on 35. And it's such a unique, cool experience to do anything on film.
Yeah. Yeah.
But, you know, as you know, you don't, may not get that opportunity anymore, but it's fun. If
all right.
You can.
I'm going to give you one secret. Promise you don't tell anyone this secret, okay?
Okay.
All right, this is just between me and no film school. So on Bernard and Huey, we only shot part of the film on Super 16 on
right.
film, just the flashback scene. So the rest we shot on the Alexa. But the Vimeo link that we sent to film festivals and to critics, let me ask you, what is the last bit of influence you can give on anyone that's going to review your film? Whether it's a programmer or a critic or a distribution executive, what is the last bit of lobbying you can do? The very last thing. All right, you don't know.
I'll tell you.
It is what is your password for your Vimeo link?
Okay.
That is the last thing that they are going to type in before watching a film.
Yeah.
So the thing we put in for our password was if see, I'm not going to say it because then people will get our link.
Is there a
anyway,
way?
So let me just say
it's
that
good that you caught yourself there.
Yeah, thank you. So let me just say that the last thing you put on, like, pick your Vimeo password very carefully and intentionally. Whatever message you want to send out to whoever is reviewing your film, that is the last thing that you do.
That's really good advice, though, because I never would have thought of that. And
yeah.
I've gotten a few since I've been up here from people.
Oh,
we
yeah,
get them all the time.
Get them all the time.
And you don't think about it because right. it's something like the title of the movie.
Yeah, title of the movie.
Plus
or some,
a number.
Yeah, or a password or whatever. Yeah, nobody thinks. But, you know, that kind of came from...
It is a secret message.
It is a secret sense. Message. And I'm trying to remember, who was it? There's a great director. The guy who directed Mystic Pizza. Don... anyway, I forget his name, but people at home can look him up because I want to attribute it to him. But he said, what is the last, he told me, what is the last thing that you say to an actor? The last way that you can, as a director, the last way that you influence an actor. You know, you can give a whisper in their ear, tell them backstory, whatever. But the very last thing you say to an actor before they start acting is action. So,
I knew that one.
Because of that, the last like way you can impart an emotion or a tone or a pace is how do you say the word
yeah.
action?
Yeah.
Do you say action or action?
You
know? And it's, I was like, oh my God, that's so genius. You know,
it
like
really
everybody,
is.
No, I'd never thought of that, but it is 100% true. Like you can set the tone of that scene the way you say the word action. And also, is it the director saying it or is it the first AD saying it?
Yeah.
It should be the director.
Yeah.
But a lot of sets, it's, you know, the director whispers action, the first AD just bellows it out.
I think I remember the first time I learned about that,
yeah.
the fact that the director doesn't always do it, was I was watching a making of Star Wars Episode I, The Phantom
right.
Menace, and I was like, George Lucas is like sitting very far away in a little video village room.
Yeah.
And some
yeah.
other guy is like talking to everybody.
Yeah.
And it struck me, it was like, oh, that's weird. And
that's weird.
I think the proof is in the pudding.
It really is. It really is because actors can't stand that. I mean, like if you're an actor, you want the director telling you action
yeah,
or not
you,
action.
That,
or...
that connection to that person who's connected
yeah.
to the big picture, literally,
yeah.
is lost.
Right.
I've never really thought about that. That's a way to emotionally connect to them before
right.
they get into it.
Yeah.
But that's the kind of thing you can only learn how to do that better, I would say, not by doing it a lot.
Right.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, and also you don't have to use the word action. I mean, sometimes I'll say, okie dokie then. You know, and like people, you know, the cast and the crew kind of know, yeah, I guess that means we're rolling. You know? Or alrighty. Yeah. You know, or you can do, you know, and I kind of learned this a little bit from Robert Altman, you know, if everyone is mic'd and you're rolling sound, you get the actors kind of improvising in character before you even roll the camera. And then you don't want to say action loudly. You know, you just kind of like wave with your hand, you know,
yeah.
because you kind of ease into that.
And he truly was the master of creating that multi-track vibe of everybody just kind of living in the moment of the scene. And like we ease into it as we watch it happening.
And it was, and I really only appreciated that when I directed Sally Kellerman, who was, you know, Oscar nominee from MASH for Hot Lips, but she was in my film Open House, my real estate musical. And she was playing kind of a drunk realtor, and all the like really younger, you know, everyone else was younger on set. You know, all the actors were like, "Dan, has Sally been drinking? You know, she seems like she's, you know, kind of in character, you know, a little bit." I was like, "No, she was trained by Altman to stay in character before the take, not just after the take, but before the take." And so, and they're like, "Oh, I get it, because we're rolling sound, you know, because you roll sound before you roll picture." And so I learned a lot from her, you know, and the other actors, these younger actors, they learned a lot from her, you know, just stay in character longer, you know, before and after the take.
You can't, it's so cool that you had an opportunity to get to know and learn directly from Robert Altman as sort of like a godfather of your own filmmaking.
Yeah.
He is really, in a lot of ways, the, like the early father of indie filmmaking as a spirit.
He really, and that's why, you know, when we were getting ready to start Slam Dance, you know, I mentioned we'd met all these other filmmakers that were excited about Slam Dance, but then a lot of them had second thoughts. They were like, "Oh," and actually one of them was here in Park City yesterday. I was talking to him and he remembered, he's like, "Oh yeah, you know, we thought we were going to get blacklisted by Sundance." So they pulled out of Slam Dance at the last minute. And so we were, so Dana called his grandfather, Robert Altman, and said, "Bob, you know, what should we, you know, there's people having second thoughts about this thing. Are, you know, are we going to piss off Robert Redford? Are we going to piss off Sundance?" And Robert Altman just thought about it for a minute and goes, "Yeah, fuck him." And that was, for us, that was the blessing of the Pope of indie film, you know. And then we said that to all the other filmmakers, and they were like, "Yeah, I guess if Robert Altman is supportive of
this. If Robert Altman says fuck him."
Yeah. Then, yeah. And then after the festival, you know, then Soderbergh, you know, basically said the same thing, and Richard Linklater said the same thing. And we're like, okay, if we have the blessing of the old guard indie filmmakers and the new guard indie filmakers, we're doing something right, you know. We don't know what.
I mean, that it's for good reason. There is a culture of carefulness about the industry, because you work with everybody. Again, you want to make sure you're good with everybody. Yeah, you want to make sure you have opportunities, and you don't turn anybody off to you. It's, you don't know where your next job is, etc.
Right.
This is all true, but it's very cool when there are people who are willing to take risks with their career or their name, because in the name of what they believe in, like Robert Altman. So, and like a lot of the people at Sundance, you guys, the founders of Sundance, it's one of the best, or Slam Dance, I'm sorry, the founders of Slam Dance. It's one of the cool things to say, we'll take that risk because what's at stake here is the independent voice.
Yeah, yeah. Of course, that said, 25 years later, Robert Altman's dead and I'm still blacklisted. But but in theory, it's worked out great. You know, so can't have everything.
Did Robert Altman ever have a Sundance? No, probably not, right?
Well, he'd had films at Sundance.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, and he'd worked with Redford before, but he had no great allegiance to them, you know.
Yeah, and he was also like a constant risk taker with whatever he was doing next.
Oh yeah, and you know, and look, at 85 he told me, "Look man, it doesn't get any fucking easier." You know, like he was still struggling to get financing on every film, struggling, you know, he was firing agents, you know, and hiring new agents. And you know, and that was at once depressing but also like encouraging. I was like, "Oh, if I'm suffering the same scars," and I had this conversation with Soderbergh the other day. I was told him the same story from Altman. He said, and he's like, "Yeah, exactly. It's just, it doesn't get any easier. But on the other hand, that we're all in this together. Like it's, you know, that's encouraging. If it's not easier for those guys, for Altman or Soderbergh, and they're suffering the same problems of financing and casting and, you know, material, you know, it's like, oh, well, I guess I'm as bad situation as they are, so that's good.
Yes, for it's me. Inspiring.
Yeah, it is inspiring.
It should
inspiring.
Be inspiring. It makes me feel better about anything.
It does,
it's
like,
well, I guess then, because I think people have a tendency to believe that someone like that is just kind of cruising.
Yeah.
They're really not.
No, they're not. No, I mean, that's why the best advice that Altman ever gave me was, you know, look, set your start date and tell everyone the train's leaving the station, and either they're on board or they're not on board, you know, and then just stick to that start date 100%. And I, you know, I mean, Dana and I have stuck with that with our films, you know, and that's how we've been able to get, you know, an amazing cast and these low budget movies, because we stick to that start date and we just, you know,
You seem like a man who's extremely laid back and low stress. Do you find when you're on set, is that just today and now, or in general when we've been in communication, on set, are you stressed, or do you maintain this kind of cool demeanor?
I do, when you're in the heat?
Because independent filmmaking, at least in my experience, it's very hard to be at the center, calm at the center of that storm.
It is very hard, and I try to be very calm as I can. And I think I've gotten better at that, you know, at sort of staying calm when all the shit is flying around, you know. And I think part of it is having had the experience of making a few films. Like, I know that, you know, if something freaks out, like, you know, if something falls through, like, that is not the end of the world, you know. I mean, I always say, like, when you're making an independent film or any film or even a studio film, you know, everything will fall through. Your actors, your cast, your locations, your camera, you know, your financing, definitely. You know, everything is going to fall through. But as long as they don't all fall through the same day, you're okay. You know, and that is, and sort of knowing that and keeping that in the back of your head is like, all right, we're out of money today, but we have our camera, so we're going to shoot today. Tomorrow we'll worry about the money, you know.
Or that's like the best advice, I think, because it's like, I remember once being on a set and it started raining and it was like, well, we can still shoot something. We still have a cast. We still have a camera.
Exactly.
But I don't think we thought of it that way. We were more just like in a panic over the misery of the one thing that befell us.
Yeah.
But you're right. If you can maintain the, like, most things are good today.
Yeah.
Then you can survive.
Then you're good. Yeah. And you just have to be an eternal optimist about it. And, you know, and also knowing that, you know, like, your first draft of your script is going to suck because by definition, it's called the first draft, you know. Yeah. Likewise, you know, the old adage, there's nothing as good as your dailies and nothing as bad as your first cut. Like, yeah, your first cut is going to suck because it's the first cut, you know, and sort of, you know, knowing that and telling your collaborators, hey, that's okay. You know, it will get better.
That's,
you know,
a sage place. That's real Zen and the art of independent filmmaking.
It's
very hard to get to a place where you can look at those things and not be crushed.
Oh, yeah, because it is.
Because it's disappointing. You have an idea of what it should be.
Yeah, likewise, your first bad review is only your first bad review. There will be more bad reviews. Wait a minute. That doesn't really... That's not exactly the same thing.
I think that was... that's an echo.
That's too far, but...
that's an echo of something Steven Soderbergh said the other day, though, too, which felt very in line with the spirit of Slam Dance to me, which was like, I don't feel like I'm taking risks because the risk is just that someone doesn't like it, and who cares? Yeah. Sort of like, wow, that's a great place to be able to rest in, to say... And then he said something like, well, if there's five in a row maybe that nobody likes, that's a problem. But like, it's true. It's like, if you can survive that, you know, you're not jumping out of a plane. You're just, you know, maybe people don't like your movie. That's okay.
Yeah. It's crushing still.
You know? Yes.
I mean, I've asked, Jules Feiffer, you know,
who's
a great playwright and novelist and cartoonist. And I've asked him, like, do you read reviews, you know? And he said when he's working on a play, he absolutely does not read the review, you know, even if it's a good review, because you don't want it to influence, you know, while you're working on it. I said, well, what about a movie? When, you know, in a movie, the film's done. You can't change anything, you know. He's like, well, I try not to read those reviews either, unless it's a really good one. Then I don't read it.
Sometimes they're really good and it has a negative effect.
Yeah.
It can.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I don't know.
That's a really cool collaboration, by the way, that you got with
me. Oh, thanks. Yeah, I don't know, did you see the video I posted on Facebook the other day? We were screening the film Lost Holiday. I think that's the name of it. It's a Slam Dance competition film. Really great film done by the Matthews brothers. And actually their father, Chris Matthews, NBC host, was in the room.
Wow, I didn't
and know. Which was very cool. Supporting his sons anyway, but it happened to be on Jules Feiffer's 90th birthday. So while I was doing the introductions for that screening, so I got my cell phone, called up Feiffer, who was at a birthday party in the Hamptons, and held it up to the mic and, you know, put it on speakerphone. And I said, Jules, we just wanted to say from Slam Dance, happy birthday. And everyone in the room yelled out, happy birthday, Jules. You know,
that's really
cool. And it was great. He really appreciated that because he's been a fan of Slam Dance. You know, his daughter had a film here. So.
Oh, yeah. He's amazing. He's one of my son's favorite books.
Yeah.
Jules Feiffer. Yeah. He's a special creative source.
So, and I think it was really nice for everyone in the room to be able to, like, go, Yeah. And they were like, oh my God, this guy's like partying like there's no tomorrow. And he's at 90, you know?
Yeah. So what's the next film?
For me?
Yeah.
I am working on a 1974 Watergate period piece thriller.
Oh, well, good timing.
Yes, exactly. yeah, I'm working on it with my friend Daniel Moya. He and I are writing the script. And our friend Terry Keefe has a great motel in the Hamptons that we're going to shoot it at.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, and again, these are all, you know, sort of...
Period is... I love the willingness to throw yourself into indie and period at the same time.
Well, I think what it was, you know, like that, like the subway scene in the garage, it was easier than I thought it would be.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, I don't have to be afraid of shooting a period piece, you know, because I was, you know, well, as an indie filmmaker.
All of Hollywood is afraid. If you go in and tell people, any producer you meet with, and you say, like, oh, it's, they're like,
that just tripled the budget. Yeah. You know?
But it doesn't have to. You're right.
Yeah, it doesn't have to. I mean, if you think about what do you need to do a period movie, it's the location, the costumes, the vehicles, you know. But if you got two or three of those in the bag, which in our case we do, our friend's motel looks like it's from 1974. So he's the one who said, hey, Dan, I've got this great motel. The Silver Sands Motel in Greenport, New York. And he gets a lot of like fashion shoots there. And he said, but no one's ever shot a feature here. You know, if you want to come in winter and shoot a feature, you know, just come up with a script that looks like 1974. And I was like, and I work backwards from there. That's, I was like, well, I've got a location.
So cool.
Now I just need a script, you know. Yeah. And what happened in 1974? Ah, Watergate. You know, okay, so now I've got like a theme and, you know, and we just needed a plot. And that was it.
It's very cool. That's, you know, when I talk to filmmakers, I often ask them where the inspiration starts with the script. And you hear interesting things like it's not just an idea. It's something like a design. In this case, it's a location.
Location.
It's just an opportunity to shoot something that will really look like it's in 1974 is such a golden opportunity.
Right.
That then just, well, what's the best story I can come up with in this
space? And that goes back to the very first film I made, Omaha the Movie. And that started because my friend Phil said, hey, Dan, we've got there's this great place in western Nebraska called Carhenge, which is an exact replica of Stonehenge built with old American cars stuck in the ground. And he said, oh, let's shoot a music video there. And I was like, no, that's too good for a music video. Let's shoot a feature there. And we did. And it's still, to this day, the only feature that's been shot there.
That's cool.
And it still looks good, and it looks kind of timeless because of that. You know,
what are you going to shoot on? That's going to be tricky, right?
That I don't know. I mean, one of the reasons I'm in Park City is to meet DPs. I mean, I don't know. Maybe we'll shoot on film, but maybe not.
There's a lot you can do in terms of creating the look.
Yeah, and a lot of it is lenses.
Yeah.
You know, I think people don't give that enough credit. I mean... Sean Baker, who's a Slam Dance alum and a good friend of mine, his film Starlet, which was like three films ago for him, you know, before Florida Project and Tangerine, he shot that on a Sony camera, but the lenses he used were like Russian Lomo lenses that had been smuggled through Bollywood and into he found them in a storage yard in the valley or something like that, you know. And but they gave such an amazing look to that film that was so unique, and you wouldn't have thought it was shot on like a Sony.
I've heard a lot of DPs and filmmakers say that the lens choice they use it to comp, like whatever they're shooting there, whatever camera they're using, the lenses are where they sort of make the decision that gives them the look that they're going
for. Oh, absolutely. And, you know, and we were lucky on Bernard and Huey. We shot with the Alexa, but we used Panavision anamorphic primos. It was literally the same lens set that J.J. Abrams shoots, you know, the big flary movies. You know? And it was like, we got the J.J. lenses, you know. But not that many people use them, so we were able to get them for not much more than any other lens. But they, you know, they lent a great quality and a timelessness to, you know, to those scenes. And then we used essentially the same lenses on the Super 16.
Cool.
Yeah, somehow they fit, or I don't know exactly how it works. But anyway, but on the other hand, then it meant that we didn't have a zoom. So it's like, okay, well, all right. So we're going to do lots of optical zooms, you know, or digital zooms in post. So, but it definitely informs a lot of the creative decisions. So like those lenses do this cool thing, which for many people is frustrating. They distort when you rack focus. Mm-hmm. which non-anamorphic lenses don't do. And my DP was like, Todd, he was like, oh yeah, you know, they do this weird distortion, so we gotta be careful when we rack. And I was like, no, that's cool distortion. Let's do more of it. You know?
Yeah, that's the thing. I think they call it like breathing. The lens breathes a little bit. Yeah, yeah. I love when I see that.
It's great.
Personally, because to me, it's sort of like, it makes me more aware of the filminess. I don't know what else to call it.
It is, it is. Like, and there's some shots in the film where people have said to me in Q&A's like, oh, what was that, you know, After Effects VFX filter you did to do that weird distortion thing? I was like, that's nothing. That is the lens. Yeah, did that all on its own.
That's something in the visual language of filmmaking we're familiar with because some older movies had that.
Exactly.
That we became accustomed to seeing a certain kind of movie from certain eras. Yeah. And it's like ingrained in our minds when we see it.
Yeah, no, there's weird things like that, like halation, which is like this, like if you have on film, you know, it was back in the film era, you know, when you shot a shot of headlights, you would see this weird double of the headlights. You don't get that on digital.
Yeah.
You know, but if you want to sort of
evoke
things, like little things like that, or like the fact that an optical zoom makes the grain bigger.
Mm-hmm.
Well, now people are trying to get rid of grain, you know, and they're like, oh, you can't do digital zoom. It makes the grain bigger. I was like, no, I want to do that. I want, you know, and so we did that even with the Arlexa shots. You know, we were able to zoom in and get better grain or bigger grain. And that evokes, again, a certain era when those optical
printers were being used. It's just like using, it's essentially like when people want to use like a sepia or something. It's like it just creates a look from a specific time.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So,
well, anyway. This has been amazing.
Oh, well, thank you,
George. I really appreciated you doing it. We get a lot of good stuff.
Yeah, good luck editing.